Please be seated. Good morning to you all. Especially we want to welcome students from Edgewood High School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. I'm told that there's a student in this class who is a relative of one of the justices. Would she please stand? How are you? And you are Kelly Crooks. Do you know anybody on the bench? You're the eldest granddaughter, I believe. Good. Well, we welcome everyone, but especially you. You may be seated. Thank you. The class is here with a special program entitled Caught with Class. And students from around the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. If the class accepts the invitation, material is sent to the class about the case. The class may engage in some special activities related to the case. They come to oral argument, and then during the lunch hour, the class meets with one of the justices who's been assigned for that day. And we are delighted you could come today. Yesterday, everybody canceled out, so which was quite understandable. The discussion with the justices relates to the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved. And anyone who wishes to may join the justices with the students after this case is completed. We, with that said, I'll first introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is grandfather, Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you all will meet. Maybe you should be joined by Justice
Crooks.
Yes,
Justice Crooks, do you have a moment to join us this afternoon?
Sure.
To say hello to... Okay.
Good. Then the two of you will do that, and you will be joined by Central Wisconsin Christian School students at Globe University, and you may or may not be joined by West Salem High School, which are due here at 1:30. I will continue on my trip down the bench. The next justice is David Prosser, and then there's an empty seat. Justice Ziegler will not participate in the case. Now, counsel will remember that she did the last time this case was heard. And at that time, Justice Rogensack was not participating, but she is today. So there is a change in the lineup for the court that differs from the last time this was heard, which is, I think, 2 years ago. Is that right? Let me call the case, the second case of the February calendar, 07AP203, Michael S. Polsky versus Daniel E. Vernon. Representing Mr. Polsky is Robert J. Cassietta, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bob Cassietta, and I represent the receiver, Michael Polsky, in this matter. Appearing with me this morning is attorney Drew Parrish. Thank you for accepting this appeal.
Counsel, first off, and we're going to ask this of Mr. Schott representing the defendants here. We were notified that, and appropriately so, that the circuit court is going to have a hearing shortly in what, less than a week, relating to was the receiver properly appointed. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'd like to hear from you, and the court would like to hear from you, whether this is really a case that we should be hearing now in light of the fact that the whole receivership may be up in air, and that may get ultimately appealed to the Court of Appeals and reviewed here. So that's my question to you. That's my question to maybe we'll deal with that question right off the bat in an unusual way. Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, thank
maybe you.
Maybe
you think it's irrelevant.
Well, it, of course, may be irrelevant if the receivership court of Grant County affirms its prior appointment of the receiver. If, however, the receivership court of Grant County determines that the receiver was improvidently appointed, then it's certainly possible that all of the effort in this case for these last several years has been for naught, and any decision or contemplation this court might give the matter is also for naught.
What do you think we should do, counsel?
Well, my preference, Your Honor, would be to move forward with the matter simply because it is ripe for a decision of this court. The pending order of the receivership court of Grant County is that the receiver was properly appointed. There have been other and unsuccessful attempts to attack the receiver in this action. And so until or unless the Grant County Court, Circuit Court, Receivership Court reverses itself or the Court of Appeals does so, it makes sense to afford this pending action judicial treatment. But I do confess, it might ultimately be a waste of time if ultimately the court of Grant County Receivership Court says the receiver should never have been appointed.
Mr. Cachetta, are you and Mr. Schott the attorneys that will be arguing that in the next week or so?
I am not, Your Honor. I am not representing the receiver in that action. I'm not certain, quite frankly, whether Mr. Schott or another lawyer is going to represent the Vernick and Moore's interests.
But does the receiver have a lawyer in that action?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Perhaps we should hear from Mr. Schott. So your position is go ahead.
It is, Your Honor.
Full steam ahead.
Full steam ahead.
All right.
Counsel, with regard to that
question. Yes, just this question.
There are, of course, in the law, so many rules and constructs. This case involves a corporation, which is a construct, an artificial construct. There is a rule of law that an appointment cannot be attacked collaterally, if not attacked at the time or acquiesced in, you know, once it's done. The proceedings before Judge Vandehei is a separate proceeding, not part of this action. This was the receiver was appointed. Lots of things happened, including then the receiver filed a lawsuit. And this is what's before us here now. Went to a 5-day jury trial. Is the issue of, if you know, is the issue being handled not just in a separate court, but in a separate proceeding from this? Does that, how does the fact that they are separate proceedings, not just separate courts, separate actions, this is a lawsuit, come into play, if at all, with your comments that we may be wasting our time?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I think that that would be answered in a long appellate road, that the managers, the controlling insiders of CPC would contend that the appointment of the receiver, if reversed by Judge Vandehei, operated as a legal nullity. And therefore, everything that the receiver did in his quasi-judicial capacity was likewise a nullity, and so too should be this action. I anticipate those are the arguments. And so to that extent, they do relate. However, I would respectfully submit that we are a long way from that and that there are many battles to be fought before we ever got to that point.
There are cases that indicate, and I'm sure cases both sides, that indicate that even if an initial appointment is erroneous, it still can't be attacked in a separate action. Now, erroneous means something different than a nullity. And so I don't know the answer, but I just ask you in case you have any guidance or comments with regard to this collateral attack in a separate and independent action.
In fact, Your Honor, that's exactly one of the issues that came before Judge Michael Kirchman in this action at the trial court level when the plaintiff receiver brought a motion to limit the testimony to exclude a collateral attack on the appointment of the receiver in this action. And there was law in this record regarding the propriety of attacking the receiver's appointment when the issue squarely before this court at the trial level was whether there was insider dealing, self-dealing, actionable self-dealing, and whether it justified a damage award. So Judge Kirchman already found to that very issue that, in fact, the Vernick and Moore's defendants could not collaterally attack the appointment of the receiver in this action. And that may very well, again, be the holding. I could see that, yes.
May I ask
Justice Prosser,
the Chief Justice, whether these questions take away from Mr. Cachetta's opportunity?
They do not, but the marshal was not then seated, and I'm going to turn to Mr. Shaw. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to
start anew.
Just a minute, okay? You may be seated for the moment.
Thank you.
Mr. Shaw, you can hold.
Thank you. First, if I may, let me update the court just briefly on the proceeding in front of Judge Vandehey. I am representing Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores in that proceeding. At the request of the bank, because of a scheduling conflict with a witness, that proceeding has now been moved to February, I believe it's 24th and 25th, okay. Or else 25th and 26th, so there's a couple of week delay, but it's not next week, but it's coming up soon.
Right. We just heard about the 9th. Go ahead. That's fine. Doesn't really matter whether it's the 9th.
I understand. If we are successful in that proceeding, and Judge Vandehey agrees with us that the receiver was improperly appointed, we will ask that, among other things, he rescind the order appointing the receiver, which would mean Communications Products Corporation is now controlled by its shareholders and directors once again rather than by the receiver. And we will seek damages against the party, the bank, that has sought the appointment of the receiver. That proceeding is primarily, although the receiver is a party to it, that proceeding is primarily between my clients and the bank that obtained the appointment of the receiver, and it is the bank's counsel, Mr. Klarkowski, who will be, is my understanding, primarily opposing the request that we're making. It is not our position that the actions taken to date by the receiver are a nullity. For example, one of the things the receiver did was sell all the assets of Communications Products Corporation to third parties who are now operating that business quite successfully, and we are not contending that somehow that sale gets rescinded and the assets go back to Communications Products Corporation. Instead, it is our position that to the extent Communications Products Corporation was damaged by the inappropriate appointment of the receiver, it is entitled to recover damages from the parties that caused those damages.
Well, what's your position in this case? Is your position in this case that if the receiver were improperly appointed, that the jury verdict is a nullity?
Yes, but let me back up for just a moment if I can. I agree with Mr. Cachetta's, in answer to your question of what should the court do now, I think at this point in time, I agree with Mr. Cachetta's conclusion that it is probably premature for the court to do anything at this point. If we are successful in getting a decision that the receiver was improperly appointed, and if we get the remedy we seek, which is that the Communications Products Corporation is being run by its shareholders and directors, I anticipate at that point in time we will make a motion to dismiss this case because the shareholders and directors of Communication Products Corporation will not feel that it's a worthwhile expenditure to continue on with this case. And that, at that point in time, we would make a motion simply to dismiss this appeal. I can't speak with certainty as to the timing of a decision by Judge Van de Hay, but at least my speculation would be that we will receive a decision from him prior to the time that this court would typically issue a decision in this case. But obviously those are two pieces of guesswork that I neither can control or accurately predict.
Well, as I understood Mr. Cachetti, he thought we should, the court should proceed at this moment with this case. Is that your position too?
Yes, I think I'm prepared to argue today. I think we should proceed with those arguments. It's ultimately, obviously, a call for this court to make. The reason I sent the letter that I did is because I thought it was appropriate for the court to be aware of what was happening. And there is some risk, I believe, as Mr. Cachetta has said, that things will develop in such a way so that the court has used its precious resources in a case that will become something that it does not need to proceed with. And I apologize for that, but it is what it is.
Okay. The court will proceed with the oral argument today. Both counsel are prepared. The court proceeds knowing that there's an issue before the circuit court regarding to the validity of the appointment of the receiver. Is that a correct statement of the circumstances as you as understand them? And what you wish?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Mr. Cachetta, is that okay with you and your understanding?
Thank you, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you. You may be seated. Marshall may start the timing, and we will begin again with Mr. Cachetta.
Thank you, Your Honor. As the court properly noted, this matter has been before this honorable court before and returned after the Court of Appeals ruled that the Beloit Liquidating Trust versus Grade decision precludes the continuation of this action. The receiver in this case takes strong exception to the application of the Beloit Liquidating Trust case or its rule to this action because this is not a Beloit case. Beloit involved creditors and their trust committee to make claims against corporate insiders which predated the insolvency or the company ceasing to be a going concern. That is, those creditors sought to make claims as creditors against the corporate actors for conduct occurring before the company closed its doors, and before the insolvency. That's one significant difference. A second significant difference is that the Beloit Liquidating Trust case did not involve self-dealing. And so it did not implicate those sections of the statutes upon which we so centrally rely for the receiver in this case. A third significant difference is that the Beloit Liquidating Trust case came to the court through bankruptcy and so never touched upon the Chapter 128 receiver obligations or duties or rights. And so the Beloit case is distinguishable from this matter in a variety of, we submit, very significant ways. But perhaps the biggest reason that the Beloit case does not serve the purpose to which it was put by the Court of Appeals is that the Court of Appeals in this matter said that because the creditors might benefit from this receivership action and because the receiver by statute has to function for the benefit of the creditors, therefore, the receiver is no different than the creditors, and they stand in exactly the shoes of the creditors, and the pursuit of this claim by the receiver is essentially Beloit. That's what I understand the Court of Appeals to be holding. That, we respectfully submit, is fundamentally flawed because it ignores the fact that Chapter 128 of the statute says the receiver does not stand in the shoes of the creditor, but in fact owns the assets, which include the claims under 128.17 and 128.19, includes the very claims that the corporation has. And the receiver in this matter has consistently spoken not for the creditors, but for the corporation, CPC. In addition to that, and just as significantly, we respectfully submit that the fact that the creditors might benefit from the conduct of the receiver is of no significance. In fact, Chapter 128 has as its title Creditors' Actions. The legislature has already contemplated the result to which the Court of Appeals objected. The legislature has found that an appropriate means for asserting claims of corporate insider dealing, self-dealing, is to have a receiver duly appointed, vested with those claims, and pursuing those claims in the name of the corporation for the benefit of all corporate stakeholders, which, yes, does include creditors.
What section of the statute are you relying on? You say that the statute says that the function is for the corporation. It takes on the claims of the corporation.
Yes, Your Honor. We're relying upon Section 180.1432 sub 3.
180.1432
2 sub 3.
Got it.
And 128.19.
Okay.
Which both specifically empower the receiver to hold the corporate assets, which would include claims, and to sue and defend the receiver's name as receiver of the corporation. Not the creditors, but of the corporation. In addition to that, Section 180.0304 sub 2 sub B gives the receiver authority to begin an action against a director or officer to recover transfers of corporate property. Again, that's 180.0304 sub 2 sub B. The common law of our state has consistently recognized these powers of receivers.
Mr. Cachetta, were those provisions in effect when all of this was occurring in
this
case?
They were, Your Honor. Yes, thank you. They were. In the Community National Bank case, which is cited in our submission, of course, the court recognized the statutory obligation of the receiver to maximize the benefit of the receivership estate. That was a statement that undermines the position of the Court of Appeals here, which essentially says because the receiver's conduct would benefit the creditors, the receiver's conduct is somehow therefore suspect. But to take that position, we respectfully submit, appeals a significant block of well-settled statutory law, reverses the common law, like the Community National Bank case, and does so for one purpose, and one purpose only. And that is to facilitate greater self-dealing by corporate insiders. That is the only legitimate purpose for the rule that Vernick and Moores assert.
Well, as I understand it, spoken broadly, got two shareholders of this corporation, right? That's it.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, there's only one shareholder, and that is Basic Products Corporation, which is in turn controlled ultimately by these two.
All right. Let's cut through, which is part of the issues in this case, of how much can it cut through this corporate structure. But it winds up that two shareholders own all of these assets, either directly, which they don't, but indirectly for owning a holding company, right? Or
true, Your Honor.
All right. Seems that what you're trying to say is that these shareholders who own everything can't deal with this corporation as they wish. I mean, they took out, the allegation is they took out $10 million, right?
We say $12 million,
right? $12 million. Well, let's not fuss about an extra $3 million, right? $10 million, $12 million, a lot of scratch, right? A lot of money. That's your plan, your thing. Now, were the corporation insolvent when this money was removed?
There is testimony from our expert witness in this case that at many times since 1999, the corporation was either insolvent or near insolvency. Mm-hmm. And if I may explain, this issue of insolvency was properly recognized, we submit, in McGivern and again in Beloit as being a difficult target to measure. Because if one chooses to measure the notion of solvency or insolvency, you'd have to assess the corporate position on a daily or perhaps hourly basis. A corporation which liabilities exceed its assets at 10 a.m. might again be solvent if they get a deposit in the afternoon mail and rush it to the bank and have funds available. So I understand, and Wernick and Moores have consistently taken the position that at all times they were solvent, pointing to net worth, pointing to the profits, and at various times, no doubt, they were, that is, CPC was solvent when these extractions were being made.
Not all the time, but at least sometimes. Is that your position?
Correct. We would concede, Your Honor, that sometimes it was solvent. I would also hasten to add, however, that if the notion of insolvency or solvency at any particular moment in time is the decisive factor, it effectively forces corporate actors into a position where they time their self-dealing to ensure that their self-dealing never drives the company that $1 over the line where the liabilities exceed the assets. And in fact, the rule that Wernick and Moores submit for this court is that there cannot be a breach of fiduciary duty as long as there is no insolvency of the corporation. Well, to adopt that rule, we respectfully submit, is to encourage self-dealers to self-deal to within an inch of the life of the corporation.
Counselor, was there ever a finding made that the company was insolvent?
At the time?
In the circuit court.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Was there ever a finding made in the circuit court at any time that the company was insolvent?
A predicate to the appointment of the receiver was a finding of insolvency. And so, yes.
The circuit court made a factual finding after a hearing that the company was insolvent.
It's my understanding, and I wasn't involved in the receivership action itself. That's a separate case, obviously, from this one. But it is my understanding, Your Honor, that yes, that the circuit court could not have appointed a receiver without a finding that the receiver, corporation was insolvent.
So you weren't involved in the proceeding where the receiver was appointed. You were retained by the receiver to proceed on this action?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay, I'll just ask opposing counsel.
Okay, well, is there in this record, and I see that there's a separate box aside from that, in this record, is the appointment of the receiver part of the record and the hearing, if there was a hearing?
There was a motion for summary judgment early in the case that addressed some of the issues of the appointment of the receiver, as I recall it, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I believe that the order appointing the receiver is in this record, but it was not, for reasons I alluded to previously, it was not part of this case because Judge Kirchman, the judge in this case, prohibited the parties, the defendants, from collaterally attacking the appointment of the receiver.
Okay.
And so in this case, essentially, the appointment of the receiver became a given with which we all dealt.
All right. Okay. So the assumption is that for the purposes of this, there wasn't a receiver appointed, that it couldn't be collaterally attacked. So we have insolvency. Well, I'll go back to my line of questioning. So you've got two people. They put it in corporate name, but they really own everything, right?
No, Your Honor. I respectfully can't accept
that. Okay, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
Can you just say you can ignore the corporation? They own it. They can do what they want as long as what? As long as they don't hurt the creditors. Beloit Corporation says if it's ongoing and unless it's ongoing and insolvent, there's no duty of the corporation to the creditors, right?
That's Beloit. That's
okay.
Correct.
So why doesn't – you told me why Beloit doesn't apply, but it seems to the ordinary person it's their money. They put it in. They earned it, the two shareholders. Why can't they do whatever they want? They want to take it out, they take it out. Why are you fussing about this?
Your Honor, the fuss is about...
Other than $12 million.
It's a lot bigger than that.
Okay.
The fuss, Your Honor, is about the very integrity of corporate governance in Wisconsin. Now, that sounds high-flung, and I understand the argument that Vernick and Moores make, that essentially they were the corporation.
Right.
We reflect that counsel argued in his opening statement, it's like taking your money from your left pocket and putting it into your right pocket.
Right.
En route from that left pocket to the right pocket is a corporation. En route from the left pocket to the right pocket is a set of stakeholders, which this Honorable Court recognized in McGivern when Mrs. McGivern was trying to get her $67,000 back, which this Honorable Court also recognized again in Beloit, saying that corporations matter. And they matter because the structures that are established by Chapter 180 require that things be done right, that things be done consistent with the statutes and the common law. And so to say that these corporate actors might have done what they did because they owned the corporation, we respectfully submit, ignores the rights of employees, ignores the rights of contract partners, ignores the rights of every other stakeholder of every kind with CPC. And the Wisconsin Banking Association, as an amicus in this matter, came forward and said that it is terribly troubled by the fact that if this Honorable Court holds for Vernick and Moores, the whole notion of corporate integrity is threatened. Now, a bank lending to a corporation will have to wonder, will corporate ownership abscond with the money? Will they take all of what might be the collateral? Will they mismanage the company through improvident self-dealing? And if this Honorable Court says that conduct is okay where the directors and the shareholders are one and the same, it's just their money, then the effect on commerce in this state will be profound because no one dealing with a corporation will any longer have the right to expect that that corporation has any vitality, has any integrity, has any real substance.
You know,
and if I may just finish,
go ahead,
Your Honor.
Sorry.
I apologize. The banks in the WBA also note in their amicus brief that they'll find a way around this, that they will figure out a way to write in loan agreements. They might mandate personal guarantees more often. They'll pass those costs along to everybody, but they may very well find a way to deal with it. The people who won't find a way to deal with it are the $600,000 or so of unsecured creditors from CPC. The mom-and-pop corporations on the square in Grant County and Lancaster who did the plumbing, who did the day-to-day work, who aren't going to get personal guarantees, who wouldn't know how to get personal guarantees, the ones who are involved in the day-to-day commerce. So, Your Honor, I respectfully submit when we measure this case against the average ordinary understanding of corporations, it is vital that this Court states unambiguously that corporations matter. Because if they don't matter, then essentially what we have in the state of Wisconsin is a free-for-all. I apologize, Your Honor, I interrupted you.
You responded, because the banks would ask for personal guarantees, which undercuts the whole point of incorporating. The whole point of incorporating is that you won't be personally liable.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's the undercut. But What you also said has bothered me about this case. There would be one set of rules where the directors and shareholders are the same in a small corporation. There'd be another set of rules for a large corporation where the offices may still be a family corporation, but members of the family are not part of the management. And another set of rules for a very larger corporation that has a lot of shareholders and none of them are in management. Is that what the result of this case is?
Your Honor, I don't believe so.
Okay.
I think the rules would be the same. The size of the corporation is not really determinative. We have consistently, the receiver has consistently held in this matter its position that all Wernicke and Moores had to do to obviate a claim was invoke the business judgment rule by getting a third-party disinterested director to ratify their acts. And that can happen whether one is a mom-and-pop, small, closely held corporation, or it can happen if you're dealing with a more substantial, more far-flung.
I agree. If we accept your view, it doesn't matter whether it's small, middle, or large. But if we accept the view of the defendants, it does matter if it's small, middle, or large.
I don't really, in all candor, understand, Your Honor, why it would matter, because the principles driving the conduct are the same. The actors might be different. The corporate structures might be different. Mm-hmm. And we have never once in this case, nor do we today, take the position that Wernicke and Moores were not entitled to a fair return on their investment, were not entitled to obtain payment for value made to CPC. That's, as I understand it, the Wernicke and Moores position, that they are entitled to unfettered access to the corporate funds.
Mm-hmm. Who is they, the shareholders?
Either as shareholders or as directors. Mm-hmm. Because recall, please, that the extractions that Wernicke and Moores made from this corporation were as shareholders in the dividend, the largest being the $500,000 dividend within a short time of their receivership, and also substantial directors' fees and other self-dealing, which arguably they engaged in because they were directors, not because they were shareholders.
Counsel, as a follow-up to the Chief's question, I understood and understand the argument of opposing counsel on behalf of the clients to be, we may be officers and directors. We are the two shareholders. And because of that, we are the corporation. We are the corporation. And because we are the corporation, we don't owe a separate fiduciary duty to the corporation. That's what I understand the argument to be. Now, I know you disagree with that. But, number one, do you understand that to be their argument? And number two, if so, does that argument call for different rules when a closely held corporation is just two shareholders and officers and directors?
That's my question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Hey, thank you, Your Honor. As to the first question, it is what I understand their argument to be. Yes. I do understand that that's exactly the position they're taking. We are the corporation.
And therefore, it's almost, I don't want to use the word with all these students, but it's almost, there's a certain incestuousness about it. That is, you know, we are the corporation, so we cannot have a separate fiduciary to a corporation because we are it.
That's right.
That's what they're saying. And if
that's different for the medium-sized corporation and a large corporation because they're not all the same. That was the point of my questioning you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that is true. There may be differences in those structures, but if the court accepts the Wernicke and Moores rule, whether in a small corporation or a large corporation in terms of general revenues and expenses and geographic scope, the result will be what the Court of Appeals predicted, which is that corporate self-dealers will, when they perceive that the corporation is in trouble or near insolvency, move themselves from last place, which is where shareholders are in the distribution line under Chapter 180, when a corporation is dissolved, they move themselves from last place to first place because they take the money before they owe any duty. If the court holds that there's no duty to the corporation, they take the money as shareholders and say, well, everyone else goes begging, which would be a clear violation of the statute unless this honorable court held that there's no duty to that corporation.
Counselor, I want to talk a little bit about your breach of fiduciary duty claim. I found it very interesting. In paragraph 114, you say defendants had a duty to undertake their duties in good faith and honest belief that their actions were in the best interest of CPC. Now, the best interest of the, for me, usually goes the best interest of the child. So tell me, what is that test? How would I know the best interest of the corporation?
Thank you, Your Honor. That test is the same test that is submitted to the jury each and every time there is a breach of fiduciary duty claim. And it asks, on a case-by-case basis, for the jury to make a determination whether the dealings between, in this case, the corporate actor and the corporation were fair. Now, in this case, to bring it right to the point the court is addressing here, there was a trial of 5 days, and the testimony included testimony regarding the various kinds of extractions. Let's take the equipment leasing trusts, in which case we for...
You're saying fair, fair to the corporation. Is that the focus of fairness, just so I understand what you're saying?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, it is the
focus. Okay, go ahead. I just want to be sure I understood.
Thank you. And this has at times been characterized as the receiver saying, well, every time you take a penny out of the corporation, you hurt the corporation. No, the receiver doesn't say that. In fact, if a penny's worth of value is provided to the corporation, it's a fair exchange, to the very heart of your question. And the reason that the conduct of these corporate insiders violated the fiduciary duty was that they were setting up equipment leasing trusts where they held the equipment and charged multiple times over market rates for the equipment leases. They were self-dealing in a way that was never ratified by a third party on behalf of this independent entity, the corporation.
Well, this corporation, as I understand it, was ongoing for a very long period of time, wasn't it? Wasn't back in the 80s that they bought it and paid, what, $150,000 and assumed $1 million+ in debt of the corporation? So this is not something that went on for a year or two, right?
Correct, Your Honor. This went on for many years.
Okay. And, I mean, isn't one of the reasons people set up a corporation to make money?
Certainly.
Okay. And if they took a ton of money out of this company and it went on for many, many years, I guess I don't see the harm to the company. It's a vehicle to make money, to limit liability unless contractually you agree to more liability or you don't operate like a corporation, then you can get the veil pierced. But, I mean, a corporation is just a vehicle to make money. It can sue and it can be sued. It's a separate legal entity. Tell me what the harm is to the corporation of paying profits out to there's nobody else that's alleging they should have these profits, right?
Well, all of the creditors have, all of the employees did at one point.
Well, you have a statute. If they're taking money out of a corporation and defraud creditors, that's a different claim. That's not your claim, is it?
It is not.
That's what I didn't think it was.
But to the very point the court raises, and thank you for asking that, the issue here is not whether they, Wernick and Moores, are entitled to take money out of the corporation.
Okay.
The issue is whether they are going to take money out of the corporation in a manner which is not contemplated by the statutes. Now, the court referenced dividends. Dividends are declared by the board of directors to be paid to shareholders out of the excess profits of the corporation. And some of the amounts that Wernick and Moores took were dividends. In addition to that, they took director's fees.
Right.
And they took lots of director's fees. Now, the jury, we respectfully submit, is entitled to figure out whether that was fair value. Were those director's fees fair? They had...
Fair to the corporation, right?
Fair to the corporation.
How would it be unfair to the corporation?
Well, the extreme examples are always the easiest. If they had one director's meeting in the entire life of the corporation...
Wouldn't be operating it as a corporation. So you've got to kind of keep them operating it as a corporation.
They held the minimum number of directors' meetings, but yet paid themselves $5 million for directors' fees. I think a jury could fairly look at that and say, I'm talking hypothetically, Your Honor, in response to your question.
Sure, I understand that.
If they gave themselves that kind of compensation as director's fees, I can't understand why a jury wouldn't be permitted and perhaps encouraged to look at that transaction and say, is that fair to the corporation, or are they merely self-dealing in a way that the legislature doesn't permit?
Well, you know, but the money that's in a corporation, any profits that are in the corporation eventually belong to the owners, right? And if this company went on for years and years, and it's functioning as a corporation, and they're taking money out, I don't see the harm to the corporation. I can see the harm that the creditors would raise if they're getting stuck with bills, but I don't see how the corporation is harmed. You have to explain that to me better.
Anytime an entity, whether a person or a corporation, which is a legal person, is subjected to treatment whereby their value is taken and they are not fairly compensated, or their value is taken in a way which is not contemplated by the law, they're harmed. If we imagine...
So I understand.
All right.
How is the value that's taken, the profits that are taken out of the company, how is that a harm? We don't have anything in our statutes that says you have to keep a nest egg in a corporation. You can run a corporation with a zero balance every year.
It's a harm, Your Honor, if value is not given to the corporation in exchange for amounts extracted. Take the salary, for example. They paid themselves a lot of money as salaries. Neither Mr. Vernick nor Mr. Morris was ever an employee of CPC. Now, that's harm to CPC. They, because they were controlling the corporation, commanded that CPC pay them a salary, even though they were never employees of the corporation. That's got to be harm to the corporation.
Well, somebody was doing some strategizing here to get the corporation to go from something that was $1 million-plus in debt to something that made, at least according to the jury's verdict, $10 million over the period of time it was in existence, right? So somebody had to be strategizing about what to do with this company.
They were very clever. And Your Honor, let me, if I may, please, also point out to you in response to that question that the jury was very critical in its analysis of what they took, because recall, they concede that they took $9.5 million. We contend we proved $12 million in extractions, but the jury only said that $6.5 million of that was improper. The jury never said, give it all back. They never did that. They said that it was appropriate for them to give back $6.5 million for which there was not fair value.
Well, okay, so your position is not, though, that you have to keep a nest egg in a company.
Absolutely.
And that's what
not.
They violated. So they could have taken everything out down to zero. You just don't think they provided enough services to the corporation or did enough for the corporation to permit them to take it down to zero.
More importantly, Your Honor, the jury didn't think so either.
Well, I know,
right.
I understand that, but we're kind of dealing with your argument here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Just want to be sure I understand. Thanks.
Yeah.
You've been very patient.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it very much.
Seems to me your argument is that the corporation is an entity, separate entity, that the directors have obligations to that entity, and that the obligation to that entity is not to jeopardize its assets so that the corporation cannot fulfill its business obligations, including paying employees, paying ordinary creditors in the ordinary course of business. Now, the corporation may be losing money, right? Corporation may just not be doing well in business for any number of reasons. But that the directors and shareholders, or at least the directors, have the obligation to the entity not to take out money which violates their trust, their fiduciary duty to the corporation. And their fiduciary duty is they pay out salaries that they get money for it. They pay dividends, it's done according to the law. they make any leases that they're fair and equitable. I've forgotten all the items that you were complaining about. But it rests on the fact that the directors owe the entity a duty of operating it according to the laws. Is that a summary of your argument?
Amen, Your Honor.
With that, you may sit down unless there's, I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
I have more questions.
Justice Rogenczyk, can I ask a question?
Justice Rogenczyk.
Yeah, I had another question. To me, your action feels like a derivative action, okay? And so my question to you is, how does the receiver in such an action satisfy 180.0740-47, which is the derivative action statute, or is the receiver just totally out of any need to do that in this kind of a claim?
Oh, the receiver is quintessentially involved in disposing of the assets pursuant to the appropriate statutory mandate. Perhaps I missed the Court's question.
So a derivative action is limited, and it's an action for an injury to a corporation, which I'm sure you know. But not just anybody can bring it. Now, I know that a receiver can bring an action on behalf of a corporation. I'm with you on that. But my question as I was reading all of this is, does the receiver, as he does so, have the same obligations as an appropriate party under Chapter 180 who proceeds derivatively?
I'm trying to think in a sort of catalog fashion of all of the potential implications, and I don't, in all candor, know. I know this, though, in a claim for self-dealing, certainly the receiver is bound, and it might be a fair way to think of the receiver's conduct as a statutorily mandated derivative action. So rather than the board of directors authorizing the claim, it's very much like the legislature, through appropriate due process, authorizing the claim on behalf of the corporation. So, yeah, I think you could properly say it's very much like a statutorily mandated derivative action.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cassetta, you gave an example of hypothetical about the director's fees of $5 million for one meeting, perhaps one meeting a year or one meeting over a period of time. But my question is, if the $5 million is unreasonable, we could proceed downward. Is there some point that you would say it was reasonable as a matter of law? I mean, how do we, what's the test to determine this is too high, but this is just right? I mean, what suppose it's here, not here?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, this is the test the jury takes when it's asked to assess those expenditures, just like it did in this case, where, in fact, director's fees were one of the issues. And we contended, through testimony presented at trial, that they were too much. And the jury made the decision about what was the right number, how much was fair. All of the other transactions, exactly the same thing, where we submitted to the judgment of a jury the amounts that were fair in all of those circumstances.
Well, my concern is jury verdicts, we go out of our way to uphold jury verdicts if there's any factual basis for them. But it seems to me what you're doing is destroying any certainty in the law, because we would uphold a verdict if they said, I think you used the figure $6 million, $4 million, $3 million. I mean, we'll probably uphold anything if it's just a matter of the jury verdict. But where's the law?
The law, Your Honor, rests in the regulated presentation of evidence at trial. It rests in the sound discretion of the jury to make a wise decision. It rests in the post-verdict authority of the trial court to reverse the jury, to remit, to add, if in fact the jury didn't follow the law or didn't consider the evidence properly, and it rests with this court's authority to review the issues on appeal. And that's one of the points we wanted very desperately to make in our submission. There are lots of safeguards for people in the position of self-dealing corporate directors. From the time they decide to self-deal, they could get someone to ratify it, an independent director. And now it's not self-dealing at all. Now it is subject to the business judgment rule. But if they decide to self-deal, they still are protected. Every dollar they take is not now automatically subject to the what they would say is the greedy receiver. Every dollar they spend is still subject to multiple protections, more than most other corporate actors have. First of all, if they never get into receivership, as I think was properly alluded to by Justice Rogensack, if they never get into receivership, these issues may never arise. We know that the creditors don't have rights against them for breach of fiduciary duty because Beloit properly applies, so long as they're a going concern and they're solvent. But assuming that a receiver is appointed, first of all, a court has to be satisfied that the receiver should be appointed. Then the receiver has to be satisfied in good faith as an officer of the court that there is a claim to be brought for self-dealing. Then the receiver has to satisfy the receivership judge that, in fact, that claim should be brought, and the court has to approve it. Then they have to find an attorney who believes in the case sufficiently to take it. Then they have to present evidence to another judge, like Judge Kirchman in this case, and that judge has the opportunity under 80206, 80208, to throw the case out. And assuming they run that gauntlet, as we did in this case, assuming that, then they present to a jury, which may say exactly what has been suggested. This is fair value. And if that is the case, then the award is zero, or there's a finding of no violation. And thereafter, all of the recourse, which is capped off by the statute that says that the receiver can be personally liable for misconduct. And they've tried that. They sued the receiver. So there are more safeguards built into what the receiver is proposing here than most other corporate actors ever imagine. And that's why it's not merely taking a number and saying it's an uncertain issue.
Is the jury instructed, not in these terms, as to the business judgment rule?
They were not, Your Honor, simply because it didn't apply here because it was exclusively self-dealing.
Well, you have to have an independent director, right, before the business judgment rule arises.
That is exactly correct, Your Honor, yes.
So there is no concept of business judgment here because it's self-dealing.
That's not in this case. That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been very generous with your time. I do appreciate it.
Mr. Schott.
Members of the court, I'm Don Schott, and with my partner Val Bailey, we're pleased to represent Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores here today. I think the best way I can think of to try to focus on the key legal issues that are involved in this case and have come out through some of the questioning is to use as an illustration the very first payment that is being attacked by the receiver here. In 1993, CPC made payments to these equipment leasing trusts that were ultimately owned by Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores. And the receiver's claim is that in 1993, the CPC caused paid to the equipment leasing trust $46,000 too much. That those equipment lease trusts were unfair to the corporation, in excess of what a fair, reasonable rental value would be. And so $46,000 in too much money was being paid to the equipment leasing trust by CPC. Now, it's undisputed that that payment was not hidden. It was disclosed on the financial statement. It's undisputed it didn't violate the provision of Chapter 180 that says you can't make a distribution that makes the corporation unable to pay its debts. It's undisputed it didn't violate the provision of 180 that says you can't make a distribution that makes the corporation insolvent. It's undisputed it didn't violate any of the provisions of Chapter 242 that deal with fraudulent conveyances. It's undisputed that all the employees got paid in 1993. It's undisputed that even after that payment, the corporation made a very healthy profit. It's undisputed that even after those payments, the corporation had a net worth that was a very significant number. It's undisputed that the payment was reported on the tax return and never questioned by any taxing authority. So the question is simply, is it a breach of fiduciary duty for Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores to authorize a payment to equipment leasing trusts that they own for an amount that can later be attacked as being commercially unreasonable or inadequate consideration? So in order for you to reverse the Court of Appeals and find reinstitute this jury verdict, you'd have to find three things. One, that as officers and directors, Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores violated their fiduciary duties when they had CPC transfer corporate assets for what's alleged to be inadequate consideration, even though that did not violate any statute or any fiduciary duty to third parties. Number two, that somehow their ratification of that action as the shareholders of the corporation is ineffective. And number three, the fact that the corporation knew about it is deemed to be unimportant, that a receiver coming in 10 years later can come back and attack that transaction.
Counsel, initially the argument sounded to me like a sufficiency of the evidence argument. That is, they were doing everything just fine with regard to leasing. Of course, there was testimony on the other side that there was a lot of sleight of hand going on here. And then the jury decided in their verdict questions and answers that there was a breach of fiduciary duty by some of this activity. So when I first heard you, I thought, well, you know, you're a sufficiency of evidence. But then when you go through A, B, and I wrote it down, A, B, and C. I don't know if you said it that way, but as officers and directors, they violated their duties and the ratification, et cetera. It sounded much more like a matter of law than a sufficiency of evidence. Can you help me with exactly what you're saying? Is it a sufficiency of evidence, or is there some legal determinations that make the conclusion of the jury that there was a breach of fiduciary duty an erroneous conclusion?
It is not a sufficiency of the evidence argument. It is that the jury was improperly instructed. It is that the case should have never gone to the jury, that the motions to dismiss and summary judgment motion should have been granted, because the law in Wisconsin is very clear, I believe, on this point. We cited on pages 38 through 41 of our brief Wisconsin law and law from other jurisdictions about the powers of shareholders to make decisions about what to do with corporate assets, and that even transferring those assets without adequate consideration is not actionable if no statute or duty to creditors is violated. We cited a number of cases, but I think one is very instrumental in understanding this concept. It's Hamilton versus Menominee Falls Quarry Company. It's a case from 1900, so it's 110, now 111 years old. But the facts there are interesting. There was a corporation called the Hadfield Corporation that was owned by three members of the Hadfield Corporation. And they were engaged in various businesses, and they decided to expand the business to open a stone quarry in Menominee Falls. And what they decided to do is do that by starting another corporation, the Menominee Falls Quarry Corporation, same three shareholders, same ownership percentages, and they transferred very valuable land from the Hadfield Corporation to their new corporation for no consideration. And then they began operating their quarry business. Several years later, the Hadfield Corporation became insolvent. And creditors of the Hadfield Corporation came in and said, wait a minute, a few years ago you took a very valuable corporate asset and transferred it to yourselves in this other corporation that you had set up, and there was no consideration for that. So that was a violation of your duty. And the trial court found that there was a transfer for no consideration, and that the transfer made the Hadfield Corporation insolvent and therefore allowed the creditor to attack that transfer. The Supreme Court said, yeah, that's the right question. Was the corporation insolvent? And the Supreme Court reversed because they found the corporation was not insolvent. And the reasoning, I think, of the Supreme Court is very important. And here's what they said. I want to quote. Quote, now, they had a perfect right to transfer this property to the new corporation for an inadequate price so far as the Hadfield Company and its stockholders were concerned, because all the stockholders of the Hadfield Company concurred in the transfer and all consented to the transfer and received benefits thereof. End of the quote. And so the question was, did it harm the corporation in another way, i.e. violate a duty to creditors? The court found it did not and said there is nothing actionable about that transaction.
Mr. Schott, I'd like to interrupt you, if I might, for just a minute and ask you about the Beloit liquidating case, especially as it relates to the decision by the Court of Appeals. As you know, the Court of Appeals, based on Beloit liquidating, said they had no choice but to rule in your favor. They then threw stones or cast aspersions at Beloit liquidating. and basically said that the Beloit liquidating rule ought to be, if not abrogated, at least modified. What is your position in regard to Beloit liquidating?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I want to say that my position is it doesn't make any difference in this case because there was never a determination of insolvency in this proceeding, and therefore it just doesn't apply to this case. But I think this Court had it absolutely right in its decision in Beloit, and that the Court of Appeals' concern is misplaced for a couple reasons. One, I think if you think about this from the standpoint of people on boards of directors, if the rule is that you, if you're an ongoing corporation, but if you get close to that line of insolvency, you suddenly have a fiduciary duty to creditors. First of all, valuing assets in a situation like that can be a very tricky business, and so where is that line? When are you insolvent or not insolvent? Where does that fiduciary duty kick in is going to be hugely uncertain. But directors will, at that point in time, have to run their corporations in a way that essentially takes no risk. They are running the corporation now for the benefit of the creditors. And, of course, the creditors don't want to risk any capital because they might lose something there. And we all know that part of what is the economic engine of this country is people take risks. Corporation takes risks. And sometimes they don't work out, but sometimes they work out spectacularly, and that's why we have economic progress. So I think the rule proposed by the Court of Appeals would really destroy that kind of risk-taking, which I think is why this Court did not adopt that rule in Beloit. I would also add another aspect of this, that I think the concern that the Court of Appeals expressed about things that could happen and why this rule needs to be put in place is simply misplaced. And I think there is no better illustration of that than the hypothetical example that the receiver gives in his opening brief, where he talks about, oh, if the Court of Appeals' result is affirmed here, all these terrible things are going to happen. Look at this situation. We have two shareholders, black and white, I think, are the shareholders and directors in their example, and they have this corporation that is insolvent to the tune of $2 million, receives a $1 million advance payment from a customer, and then the shareholders, directors abscond with that payment to the, pay it to themselves, and suddenly XYZ Corporation can't pay his employees, can't pay its creditors, can't pay even that poor supplier who had made the advance payment, and that would be a terrible result. I agree, it would be a terrible result, and it is absolutely crystal clear, protected under existing law. We went through all the statutes in our brief that would be violated by such a transfer, and the receiver said absolutely nothing about that in his reply brief, which I think is an indication that we're absolutely right about that. And so the fear that the Court of Appeals obviously was motivated by in its Beloit decision, the Court of Appeals here in its Beloit decision, I think is just misplaced. So
would it be fair to say that you're asking us to affirm the Court of Appeals, but on different grounds, on the grounds that you're arguing here today?
No. but here's why. Here's why. Because I think that the Court of Appeals, I want you to affirm the Court of Appeals because I think they came to the right decision. I think the receiver has always said, we are bringing this action on behalf of the corporation, not on behalf of creditors. And we're bringing this action under Chapter 128. But Chapter 128 does not give the receiver anything other than an ability to stand in the shoes of the corporation. It doesn't give a corporation any claims that aren't someplace else. Chapter 128 does not create claims on behalf of a corporation. So the receiver, yes, stands in the shoes of the corporation, but what claim did the corporation have? Is there a violation of Chapter 180? No. Is there a violation of Chapter 242? No. Is there a violation of a fiduciary duty to creditors under Beloit? Clearly not. Therefore, there is no cause of action that the corporation had. The receiver may stand in the shoes of the corporation, but that doesn't mean that he has any ability to bring any claim if the corporation had no ability to bring a claim. And that, of course, is exactly what the Supreme Court held in the case we just discussed, the Menominee Quarry case, and has been held in a number of other cases that we cite in our brief from other jurisdictions. The Seventh Circuit case that I think is probably factually as close as any case anybody has found to this situation is the Doctors' Hospital of Hyde Park case. where sole shareholder owns a corporation called Doctors Hospital, and like here, has business dealings with that corporation. He personally owns land that is rented to the corporation. He personally is paid a management fee by the corporation. Doctors Hospital eventually goes bankrupt. A bankruptcy trustee takes over and makes claims against, it's a Mr. Desnick is the a shareholder here, makes claims against Mr. Desnick for breach of fiduciary duty, then wants to settle those claims, and one of the creditors objects to the amount of settlement as being too low, so the court is examining whether or not the settlement proposal is reasonable. And in doing that analysis, the court, Seventh Circuit, points out, well, when you think about this claim that is being made by the corporation against Mr. Desnick, there is no claim unless and until Doctors Hospital is insolvent. Because they say, quote, when as the sole shareholder, Desnick could hardly have defrauded or breached a fiduciary duty to himself. And there are a number of other cases we cited in our brief that deal with that exact same situation.
Okay. And that's between 38 and 42. So if you look at Doctors Hospital, which is referred to on page 42, everyone agrees there's no viable claims for any period during which the hospital was solvent. That is because as long as a corporation is solvent, directors typically owe fiduciary duties only to the shareholders. So my question here is, was this corporation solvent? And when? And when not? Which is the first question I asked of opposing counsel. And if you look at the others, cases that you cite, on page 39, State versus Milwaukee Electric, private corporations are organized for private profit, and except as to their members and creditors, are free to exercise their judgment over expenditures, nay, even the donation of their funds. So there it seems as if there's a creditor obligation. Davies versus Meisenhower. The court recognized the absolute power of shareholders to conclusively, ratify any, and you have any emphasized, legal corporation transaction, provided no creditors are harmed. So that's Davies. Again, no creditors. The next one is transaction, if within the powers of corporation, may be consented to, ratified, or acquiesced by the shareholders or by the board if it could be authorized by them. So it's not totally clear. If it's consented or ratified with full knowledge, it is finally and absolutely binding, and neither the corporation nor individual stockholders nor strangers can afterwards sue or otherwise attack. Question is whether they could authorize it if the corporation was insolvent. Western, and you cite all this. I'm reading right from your brief, so you've made absolute full disclosure of what these cases say, at least as far as you went. The owners of a stock in a corporation may commit the corporation to certain obligations, assuming that the rights of creditors are properly respected. So you have creditors here all the time. So it's not absolute that shareholders can ratify and everything is okay.
Absolutely. That's absolutely,
absolutely
correct.
Absolutely, it's not absolute.
And that's absolutely been our position, that there cannot be harm to, there cannot be violation of a statute, and there cannot be a breach of a fiduciary duty or harm to creditors. Now, your question to me was there ever a determination of insolvency here? The answer to that is no, there was not. The jury was never asked. You can look at that special verdict form. There's nothing on that special verdict form that deals with insolvency. Prior to the trial, we wanted to raise the issue of insolvency, not to collaterally attack the appointment of the receiver, as the receiver has just argued, but instead because our argument was there was no damage to this corporation by anything that my clients did. The damage to this corporation came by the bank appointing a receiver, and once the corporation is known to be in receivership, it suddenly starts losing customers, losing business because people that are buying their product don't want to be dealing with a company that they fear may no longer be around and be unable to supply them. So we wanted to prove that the corporation was not insolvent at the time of any of these transactions being made. The receiver objected to that, and the trial court agreed to that objection and did not allow us to put on any evidence of insolvency. The only evidence that comes close to relating to this question is Trial Exhibit 74. It's part of the record in this case. It's a chart prepared by the expert witness retained by the receiver that analyzed the financial statements not only of Communication Products Corporation, but also the of Basic and CPRO, the ultimate parent, and came up with a net worth calculation of all those corporations. And it said that there were times when CPRO, the ultimate parent, had a negative net worth. And so the receiver's expert said, well, then, to the extent that one of the assets of Communication Products Corporation is money that it might be expecting to get from CPRO, we should disallow that because it may not get paid. And even after excluding that, that's the intercompany receivable, even after excluding that, on Exhibit 74, the far right-hand column, every single number is a positive number. Every year that was analyzed by the receiver's expert says CPC had a positive net worth. It was never insolvent.
I thought she testified to it not being insolvent because the loans that were set forth were, in fact, cash withdrawals, that there were inflated lease payments, duplicate salaries, management fees, and dividends from the different corporations. And that's only, and this is my word, not hers, but only this shuffling between CPC and Basic, which is kind of a shell, and CPRO or whatever it is, that they could keep things in the black, but it really wasn't in the black because of this shuffling and these artificial constructs. I thought that's what it was, her testimony of the expert.
What her testimony was and what she illustrated on Exhibit 74 is that there is a book value of CPC's net worth. And included in that is this intercompany receivable. And her testimony was, I think you should exclude that entirely in determining the net worth of CPC because of the various things that you just mentioned. And then she has another column that says, here's the net worth when you subtract out that money in the intercompany receivable. And it's that column that I referred to when I said every single number is a positive number. It was always a positive net worth, even excluding that intercompany receivable.
Counsel, I want to follow up with Justice Crook's earlier question regarding Beloit. We have an amicus from the Wisconsin Bankers Association. And they take the Court of Appeals to task for expanding the Beloit case here. They suggest that Beloit was a case that involved a fiduciary duty to creditors, or explored that, and that here we're talking about a fiduciary duty to a corporation. They say at the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2, Beloit meant that creditors cannot rely on a fiduciary duty to creditors during this period to prevent corporate looting. The Court of Appeals decision now means that creditors cannot rely on fiduciary duties to the corporation during this period. Beloit, as now interpreted, and let me insert by the Court of Appeals, creates a serious risk that there may be a time when insiders of a corporation face no legal consequences to anyone from self-dealing, which could make self-dealing during this period even more likely. They assert, continuing, there is no justification in law, public policy, or common sense to permit this extension of Beloit. Now I'm jumping one line, and they say, ultimately, it will significantly increase the costs and burdens of doing business for corporations. So how do you respond to that, that they're saying the Court of Appeals inappropriately now has extended the Beloit case to apply to fiduciary duties to corporations, and that there's going to be great consequences to this kind of expansion?
Thank you. Two responses. First, the Court of Appeals did not expand Beloit. The Court of Appeals did not expand Wisconsin law. The Court of Appeals made a decision that was very consistent with Wisconsin law, as demonstrated by the Menominee Falls Quarry case, the other cases we cited in our brief, the Doctors Hospital case, and other cases that we've discussed from other jurisdictions. That has always been the law in this state. In terms of the argument that the bankers have that somehow this will create all sorts of difficulties for them in the financing realm, here, the bank, that's a matter of contract. The banks can protect themselves through contractual arrangements, which they did here. They had a net worth requirement. They had a requirement that they get audited financial statements. They had other protections built into their loan package. They tried to get personal guarantees. Mr. Vernick and Mr. Morris said, no, we won't give you personal guarantees. And the bank said, okay, we will go ahead. We will make this loan to you without the personal guarantees. They made a choice. They made a business decision to go ahead without personal guarantees and take that risk. And if they think that there was any violation of any of their contract rights by Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores or by CPC, they could bring an action to say that. If they think that there was something on those financial statements that was misrepresented or fraudulent, they would have every right to bring an action based on that. If they think Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores lied to them or somehow deceived them, they would have every right to bring an action based on that.
Counsel, your opposing counsel says, as you also indicate, that the bankers indicate that they can write things into the contract to protect themselves. Your opposing counsel says, what about the $600,000 of others, including, you know, of course, the illustration is made to for a purpose, and that is the mom-and-pop business on Main Street, the plumbers, you know, that don't have the opportunity to write in things to protect against self-dealing or looting. How do you respond to that?
I respond in a couple ways. First of all, this term self-dealing and looting. If by that you mean transfers out of the corporation that have the effect of defrauding a creditor, of making the corporation insolvent, of hindering any creditor's right to get paid, all those things are already protected against by the statutes that exist. I think part of the problem we've had here is there's been a lot of loose language about this is like Enron, this is looting, this is insider trading, and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, if the bank or any creditor felt that there had been a violation of any of those statutes, if there had been any kind of fraudulent conveyance, if they thought there had been a transfer that made this corporation insolvent or was made at a time that the corporation was insolvent, they had a statutory claim they could have brought. They didn't bring it. Instead, they did an end run around that statute and say, we can't bring any of those statutory claims. We can't bring any contract claim. We can't even bring a misrepresentation or fraud claim. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to say that the law in Wisconsin is that you have a fiduciary duty to your corporation, and if you negotiate an equipment lease that ends up paying you $46,000 more than we think 10 years after the fact it should have, we can come back and attack that. Now, imagine what that means for every small business in Wisconsin that has all sorts of relationships where there's a corporation that leases its building from one of the owners, and they have a decision every year as to what that lease rate is going to be, and it's talked about with the accountants, and it's reported on the tax returns, and for 10 years, nobody raises a question. And then suddenly there's a financial problem with that institution or that corporation, a receiver is appointed, and they can go back 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and undo that transaction, second-guess those decisions, say that level of director fees were too high, or we're going to let a jury decide whether that level of director fees were too high. The uncertainty that will exist is absolutely amazing. Now, one of the cases, and the Chief brought it up in her questioning of me before that we cited in our brief, is Davies versus Meisenheimer, I believe is the pronunciation of that case, which I think is a perfect illustration of this example. That was a family business, five siblings, four brothers and a sister owned all the stock in that corporation. One of the brothers was apparently running the corporation, had the title of president, and during a multi-year period of time took loans from the corporation, not for any business purpose, but because he could. And all of those transactions were disclosed to the shareholders and ratified by all the shareholders. Then one of the shareholders dies, and one of her children inherits the stock. And that child sues her uncle and says, you have to pay that money back to the corporation because there was no business purpose for that loan. There was no value. There was no consideration for that. And the court said, no, no, no. When actions like that have been ratified by the shareholders, you can't come back later as a receiver, as a subsequent owner of the corporation through purchase or a shareholder that obtained stock and try to undo those transactions. Just think of the uncertainty that that would cause within our businesses in this state if that were the rule. And that's really what's happening here, is that the receiver wants to come back and say, we're going to look over every transaction that Mr. Vernick and Mr. Morris had with this corporation over the last 15 years that they've owned it. And if we can find somebody to say, well, you paid a little too much on this or a little bit too much over here, we think we can attack that transaction.
You know what? For me, part of the difficulty of this case is that it's so insular. You have two people and the whole argument that we are the corporation. So the ratification in this kind of a case would be done by, and I don't know if they did or did not do self-dealing, but the very people that are alleged to have self-dealt and therefore breached their fiduciary duty. So how does your ratification argument, which I understand to be, hey, look, once it's ratified, it's untouchable. But if it's ratified by the very two people who are accused of self-dealing, how does that play out?
To be clear, my ratification argument is not that if they ratify it, nobody can touch it. It is still subject to the rule that it has to be something that doesn't violate a statute and doesn't violate a fiduciary duty to others.
Hey, I misspoke then. Thank you.
Pardon?
I said I must have misunderstood. Thank you.
Well, and I apologize if I didn't articulate it quickly.
Well, but in
before.
Davies and the ratification, it's a shareholder whose predecessor has approved. Now they're complaining. It looks like waiver or estoppel, usual kind of things. I don't remember in Davies that there are creditors who suffered as a result of that or employees. So your ratification cases, if that's what they involve, only shareholders and a fight among the shareholders, it's not what's here. In this case,
I'm not sure if there was any mention of creditors in the Davies case, but there is a case from the Seventh Circuit that the receiver relies on heavily that deals with exactly this issue, and that's Scholes versus Lehman.
Is that in 38 to 42 in your case? Go ahead.
I believe it's included on pages 32 to 37 of our brief.
Okay.
It's a Seventh Circuit case where a Mr. Douglas set up three corporations in which he was the sole shareholder of each. And then he used those corporations as part of a Ponzi scheme to take advantage of investors, take in money, promising great returns, never really investing the money in anything. And then the Ponzi scheme crashed. Douglas is put in jail. The corporations are taken over by a receiver, and the receiver is suing people that got some of the first payments out of the Ponzi scheme, trying to get the money back to distribute it to everybody. And Judge Posner wrote this in talking about the claim that the corporations would have. Quote, as sole shareholder, Douglas could lawfully have ratified the diversion of corporate assets to non-corporate purposes, but only if creditors were not harmed.
Right. And that's what Scholes says. So Scholes said that the creditors that in the absence of creditors, sole shareholder could lawfully divert. Here we do have creditors.
We have no proof, nor was the receiver's theory built on a theory that he had to show any damage to creditors by these transactions. Go back to the $46,000 payment in 1993.
That's your favorite one.
Well, it's the beginning one. It's the first one. It's a great illustration. But you can make the same argument with respect to any of the other payments. There was no connection that was shown, and the receiver doesn't claim he has to show any connection between saying, because that $46,000 was paid in 1993, some creditor in 2003 didn't get paid. It could be that the corporation, if he hadn't paid the $46,000 to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Morris, would have invested that in the corporation, expanded, gotten bigger, incurred more debts, and then, in fact, when the economy turned in the early 2000 and foreign competition became more severe, they would have had more debts and more creditors and more people that were in danger of not getting paid, not less. This verdict cannot be sustained on the basis that there was any causal connection between these payments and any creditor not getting paid. The main creditor in this case is the bank. Most of the payments that are at issue here were payments that had been made to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Morris and were known to the bank at the time it decided to make a loan to CPC in 1999 without a personal guarantee.
Earlier you indicated that there had never been any determination of insolvency by the jury. Was there ever a judicial determination of insolvency, and if does the record reveal this? And if so, at what point was there a determination that the corporation was insolvent?
I'm going to separate out the two proceedings. The proceeding that's on appeal here, the proceeding before Judge Kirchman, no, there was never a determination by him either on the question of insolvency. His view was that that was irrelevant. The receiver was appointed, and the question of insolvency was irrelevant. It was irrelevant to the receiver's claims. The receiver does not claim that any of the damages it alleges that it's entitled to depend on a finding of insolvency at any point in time. So there was no such finding in this action by either the judge or the jury. The action in front of Judge Vandehey, where the receiver was initially appointed, recall that was done on an ex parte basis. He granted a motion on an ex parte basis and then set up a subsequent hearing to take further testimony on the question of insolvency. To make a long story short, events kind of overtook everything. And that is the evidentiary hearing we're going to have in a couple of weeks from now, going back to that initial issue of, in fact, was this corporation insolvent?
Thank you.
We don't have that original appointment of the receivership in our records here. Is that correct?
None of the proceedings that led up to that are there. I don't know for sure, but there may be a copy of the order appointing the receiver. That would be judicial.
It wouldn't be a hearing on the appointment of the receiver or the underlying findings of the court.
Correct.
It was an ex parte order for a receiver?
Yes.
And then after that, apparently, there was a stipulation, an order authorizing the receiver to sell property and disperse the sale proceeds. I suppose all of this stuff might be argued before in the next proceeding.
Yeah, I think one of the things the bank intends to argue, let me back up and explain what happened. The receivership started in June. As I mentioned before, the commencement of a receivership has serious consequences to any business, and customers become nervous about dealing with a company that's in receivership. So a real effort was made, and it was determined that it was really in everybody's best interest to try to sell the company as a going concern if they could. And so the assets of the company were sold in, I believe it was September of 2003.
The stipulation of the parties and the order entered upon it was in June, right at the same time, June 30th, 2003. According to CCAP, I don't know. Maybe the CCAP is wrong. I'm not saying it is or isn't. We've had a case about that.
I believe there was a hearing on June 20th of 2003 where they began the process of gathering evidence on this question of insolvency. That hearing was never completed, and then the agreement to sell the assets took place, and there's a dispute now between us and the bank as to whether Mr. Vernick and Mr. Morris preserve their right to continue to challenge the appointment of the receiver. That's one of the issues that Judge Vandehey will decide in connection with the February proceeding.
So at the time of the appointment, there was a stipulation, too,
in the same
there was a stipulation that allowed the sale of the assets.
Got it.
because we didn't want to have a situation where no purchaser would purchase the assets if there was a question about the receiver's legal ability to give good title to the assets.
But apparently not a stipulation as to insolvency.
Never a stipulation as to insolvency, yes.
I understood Mr. Cachetta say that a determination of insolvency was a prerequisite to the appointment of a receiver.
The statute, Chapter 128, says a court can appoint a receiver upon a finding of there being insolvency. In this instance, an ex parte motion was made asking the court to appoint a receiver on an ex parte basis, and Judge VandeHei did that. Now, frankly, one of the arguments that I have in front of Judge VandeHei is that it was inappropriate to proceed on an ex parte basis in doing that. He could have issued an injunction saying you guys can't transfer assets or things of that nature, but appointing the receiver and giving the receiver control on an ex parte basis, I believe, is improper under Wisconsin law. But it happened.
Well, what about gathering evidence in June? You said June 20th, 2003, they gathered evidence. Was that in court?
Yes. Judge VandeHei issued the order on June 3rd and then set a hearing date, I believe it was on June 20th of 2003, to give CPC an opportunity to be heard on the question of insolvency.
Okay.
That hearing began. The receiver, because it was the receiver's motion, went first, put on some testimony with respect to the insolvency issue, and Judge VandeHei had allotted a certain amount of time, I don't remember how much, but a certain amount of time. That time was completely consumed by the witnesses that were called by the receiver, and then the hearing was never resumed. As I said, the press of trying to make sure that whatever value was still there in the corporation could be salvaged led to this stipulation that says we will agree that the receiver has title to sell the assets, and in our view, we reserved our right to challenge the appropriate appointment of the receiver, and those
is
are all
issues. Is that in writing in the stipulation?
Yes.
That you reserved the right to challenge the receiver?
I didn't write the stipulation. That is an issue where there is a dispute now between us and the bank, and Judge VandeHei will have to decide what the scope of that
stipulation
document
was.
Is.
Got it. Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you. Counsel. Mr. Cachetta.
Thank you, Your Honor. The position of Wernick and Moores, the rule that they state, could be predicated with ignoring the fiduciary duty to the corporation, then there is only a violation if you violate a statute or breach a duty to somebody else. The difficulty with that articulation of a rule, however, is that for a long, long time, this honorable court has recognized that there is a fiduciary duty to a corporation. And it cannot be ignored, nor is there any good reason for ignoring that there is a fiduciary duty to the corporation. In fact, the Scholes case, which counsel addressed in his argument, goes to the very heart of whether the receiver should be the proper person to assert claims for the corporation. Now, before I talk about Scholes, let me just point out that Cream City Mirror Company case, which is cited at page 37 of our first brief, that Cream City case properly, we respectfully submit, properly recognizes that the receiver cannot bring a claim for the creditor's rights. So it would have been inappropriate, in violation of the long-settled law, for the receiver in this action to have brought a claim for the creditor's rights. The receiver had to stand in the shoes and act on behalf of the corporation. Now, and I'm working back to Scholes here. The defense, Wernick and Moore, suggest, well, the creditor should bring these claims under 242, fraudulent transfers, or they might sue for a breach of contract. All of those are proper claims, perhaps, if the facts support them. But the creditors also have the right under Chapter 128 of Wisconsin law to proceed to circuit court and obtain the appointment of a receiver. And in fact, this is where Scholes addresses that very question. Should the rule that the Wernick and Moore's defendants are asserting be the rule, or is it better to have these kinds of claims prosecuted by the receiver? And the court there said, now that the corporations created and initially controlled by Douglas are controlled by a receiver whose only object is to maximize the value of the corporations for the benefit of their investors and any creditors, we cannot see an objection to the receiver bringing suit to recover corporate assets unlawfully dissipated by Douglas. We cannot see any legal objection, and we particularly cannot see any practical objection. The conceivable alternatives to these suits for getting the money back into the pockets of its rightful owners are a series of individual suits by the investors, which, even if successful, would multiply litigation. A class action by the investors, and class actions are clumsy devices, or most plausibly as adversary action in bankruptcy, brought by a trustee. The courts have consistently, Scholes is just one example, said that the receiver is the proper party for purposes of bringing this kind of claim. The Davies case, Davies versus Meisenheim, that was referenced, it involved neutral ratification. This case has no component of neutral ratification. The Hamilton case that was referenced was a fraudulent transfer action. It was not a case by a receiver. The other cases cited by counsel either consistently do not deal with self-dealing or do not address Wisconsin statutory law. But there is no case cited by Wernick and Moore's or their counsel which says that there is not a fiduciary duty to the corporation. And if there is a fiduciary duty to the corporation, I respectfully submit it becomes the province of this court to decide whether that duty has any vitality. The Wernick and Moore's defendants would say there is a fiduciary duty that cannot be enforced when the shareholders and directors are essentially unified in interest. And I ask what the possible purpose of that rule would be other than to facilitate self-dealing. Otherwise, there is adequate protection through the receivership process for some rogue receiver who decides to track every penny ever taken by any self-dealer. There is the safeguard of a jury looking at whether the transactions are appropriate. And the only
say in the statutes that self-dealing is bad. Why is self-dealing bad? Where does it say self-dealing is a violation of anything? I mean, I think that's what the defendants are saying. If they ratify it, so what?
Well, the ratification is always neutral. Otherwise, ratification lacks meaning.
Okay, so there is no ratification here.
Right. And the notion of self-dealing is, look at McGivern. I think Beloit touches upon it. The key cases, and certainly the entire, and there's that book we cited by Dean Davis and the way that corporate management has to be handled in Wisconsin, all of which are premised on this notion that self-dealing is bad in that it defeats proper corporate governance unless it's properly ratified. If a disinterested party looks at the self-dealing and says, yep, that's okay, then it is in fact okay. But absent that ratification, the difficulty with self-dealing is that it permits someone to undermine proper corporate governance. I see I have a red light. My thanks for your courtesy.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? All right. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Attorney Cachetta and the third Attorney Schott for once again appearing before us at two-year intervals, and on the basis of our initial discussion, it might be another 2 years before you appear before us.
Hopefully on a different case.
Yes, right. That concludes our hearing in 07AP203, Michael Polsky versus Daniel Vernich. The court is in recess until 1:30. The students may remain, and Justices Bradley and Crooks will be out to talk with the students and any others who join us. Court's in recess.